delivered by Edley's Barbecue. Follow us on Twitter, social media, at Midday 180, at 104.5 The Zone. Today, live from Nashville Speed Shop. We just went in their like third garage over here with all the Ford Broncos.
It's a beautiful black Ford Bronco. 1972, I think you said.
Amazing. It's yours. It's a Withrow.
It is.
John Feinstein joins us. He joins us each and every Monday as we hit the national headlines. John, hope you're doing well.
All is well here, Jonathan. Today is my daughter Jane's 10th birthday.
All right. The
celebration's been going on for about a week now.
Yeah, that's a big one. They like to stretch it out, so take it as long as you can get it.
She asked me last night how I felt knowing I would never be putting to bed a child who was single digits old for the rest of my life.
They love the double digits.
They love the double digits. You're right, Paul.
Baseball, I'm not a fan of either of these teams. Dodgers a game away, but game four on Saturday night, the back and forth nature, and then the play that won it with the Dodgers making two errors, still somehow felt like Tampa Bay made a play on that, even though the Dodgers was giving it to them. I thought it was a classic baseball game.
It was one of those postseason games that'll be remembered for a while. Whether you're a fan of the two teams or not, and especially because of the ending, it was a little bit like, I mean, different play, obviously, but a little bit like the Bill Buckner play in 1986 when the ball went through his legs and Mookie Wilson ended up on first and Ray Knight scored from second base. Game was tied then. A lot of fans forget the game was tied. The Red Sox would not have won the World Series at that moment if Buckner had made the play. And obviously the Rays didn't win the World Series. After the two misplays. I'm not sure I've ever seen a major league catcher lose the ball like that at home plate, trying to sweep it across the plate to make a tag when there was nobody to tag at that moment. So it was a wild and crazy ending. And I'm like you, Paul. I don't have strong feelings for either team. I've known Stan Kasten since he was in Atlanta, so I have some warm feeling for the Dodgers there. But you can't not love the Rays and the way they put this team together and the way they've gotten this far in the World Series. I would like to see a Game 7. I just would like to see a Game 7. I think this World Series deserves a Game 7.
I just can't help be struck by the fact that there are fans there. And if there are fans there, then why not have fans in L.A., a classic ballpark, and Tampa Bay, a dump,
really a dump, Paul.
But their dump.
It is their dump, and they get very defensive about it. I tweeted a couple years ago, you might remember, the opening game of the Major League Baseball season was played in Tampa. I think it was, I don't remember, maybe it was the Yankees and Rays, I don't remember. But I tweeted something about, yeah, if you're Major League Baseball, why would you want to open your season in Wrigley Field or Fenway Park when you can open in the Tropicana Dome or whatever it's called now? And I swear to God, I got hate tweets from people down there. We love our ballpark, and who are you to criticize it? And they're very defensive about it. But it is a dump, you're right. And I hear what you're saying, but the thing is, you know, they planned this many, many, many weeks in advance. And none of it, and Florida is one of the worst places for COVID because they have an idiot governor. So it really depends from place to place what's safe and what's not, and different states have different laws. So I'm with you. I'd love to see – I love seeing games at Dodger Stadium, but it just wasn't meant to be this year.
John, what are some things, and maybe there's only one or two, that you really liked about the 60-game schedule and the way the playoffs have been that you hope baseball carries over to an extended season and a regular season when we get back to normal?
Pretty much nothing, Paul. I'm okay with the universal designated hitter. I've been back and forth on that ever since 1973 when they first brought in the DH. Remember, the DH came into play because they didn't think there was enough scoring in the American League. So that's how it began. And there's part of me that likes the idea that everybody in the lineup can hit. There's another part of me that likes the strategy of, you know, when do you take out a pitcher and when do you double switch, things like that. I'm Billy Martin on this. I feel strongly both ways. So if they went to the universal DH, I'd be fine with it. And I think they might, but we'll see. Nothing else. The seven-inning doubleheaders will go away because we don't have doubleheaders in a real season. And when they are forced to have one because of weather or whatever, they always make it two single-admission games. You don't get a real doubleheader. When I was a kid, I would go to Shea Stadium on Sundays and pay $1.30 to see two games. Yankee Stadium was $1.50 to see two games. We're a long way from that, obviously. I hate the idea of the guy on second base. It's little league stuff. What's the one other thing I hate? The expanded playoffs. One of the things that makes baseball unique is you got to be good to make the playoffs. You know, very rarely does a team with fewer than 90 wins get into postseason. Even with when they expanded the wild card a few years ago, you still are talking 10 good baseball teams. Occasionally, you know, somebody might slip in with 86 wins or something, but it's very rare. This year with the 16 teams, there were two teams that made the playoffs with under 500 records. Would that happen over 162? I don't know, but I suspect it would.
The thing that's driving me crazy is the way they're talking about records. Most home runs in a postseason, most whatever, blah,
yeah,
blah, blah, blah. You got three extra games at least, right?
Yeah.
Maybe five.
Well, and so, the other thing, Paul, is the way people talk about records now. I saw a thing, I can't remember which game it was, where maybe it was, I think it was the Astros, where for the first time in history, a base playoff game started with a home run and ended with a walk-off home run. So what? And, you know, it's funny you bring that up because I was watching the Coastal Carolina game on Saturday afternoon. And when Coastal Carolina, which was a great story, won the game, I think Georgia Southern they were playing. And they win the game, and the woman who was doing play-by-play starts screaming for the first time. And I'm waiting for the first time in history. You know, since 2015, Coastal Carolina is 5-0. What? For the first time since 2015? We do this with stats all the time now. You know, people say, for the first time since 2017, whatever. And we're seeing it, you're right, Paul, with the baseball playoffs right now.
Oh, that's really funny. Not a great day if you're in the Bill Belichick camp of Belichick versus Brady and who gets more credit for the Patriots dynasty. Tom Brady and the Bucks looked incredible, and Tom Brady looked as good as I've seen him look in years. And boy, oh boy, Cam Newton after the game is saying his job's in jeopardy. So you know it was a bad day for the Patriots against the 49ers.
Yeah, I watched a lot of that game, and Cam Newton was terrible. I mean, he was just awful. He's a better football player than that. But the thing you got to realize is the Patriots just aren't very good. And some of that is on Belichick because he's the boss there. But some of it is because they had guys who opted out. They have guys with COVID-19. I think they practiced three times during a 14-day period. During the season especially, that's got to set you back. I am not going to jump after six games on the, oh, Belichick was all about Brady bandwagon. I still think Belichick's a brilliant coach. Now, I also think Brady is the greatest quarterback who ever lived. And what he's doing at age 43 is remarkable, but let's remember, he's got some pretty good weapons that they've signed up for him down there. And if Antonio Brown doesn't make a fool of himself, which is at least a 50-50 bet, and can get on the field and play, they're going to be a very dangerous team, especially in the NFC. I still think the four best teams in football are probably in the AFC, you know, with Pittsburgh, with Baltimore. I'm going to say four of the five best because I'm still keeping Seattle in the elite group. They're four of the five best teams in football are in the AFC right now, and which is why the Bucs have a legitimate chance to make some hay in the playoffs.
John, did you take the decision to sign Antonio Brown? Is Brady having some personnel decision-making control in everything? Bruce Arians was adamant that they were not going to bring him in, and it's week 7, and he signed.
Yeah, and of course he couldn't play until after week 8 because of the suspension, so that makes sense. But if you believe that Tom Brady had no say in this at all, I have some oceanfront in Oklahoma I'd like to sell you. Why wouldn't you listen to Tom Brady? See, that's what I don't understand with Bruce Arians. They, oh, he had nothing to do with it. The guy's been in the NFL for 21 years. And the thing that I would have said to Tom Brady is, are you certain he's not going to destroy what we got going in the locker room? Forget whether he can play or not. If he can't play, you just cut him. But Brady and the Bucks decided it was worth the gamble, and why not? And they also, how does Bruce Arians suddenly know that Antonio Brown has matured? I mean, I love it when coaches say, oh, he's matured. You know what that means in English? We still think he can play.
The return of Big Ten football this weekend, John. I know you love the underdog story, the underdog football story. Tom Allen at Indiana can coach some ball, and he showed that once again by upsetting top 10 Penn State. I say top 10. They hadn't played a game. A lot of other teams had.
They were
predicted
top 10.
To be very good. They were top 10 for sure, so it counts as a top 10 win. But what do you make of that upset win for Tom Allen and what he's done at Indiana, a place that you know well, is very difficult to win football games at?
Yeah, because nobody really cares. I mean, football at Indiana is sort of like football at Duke. It's what they do until they can start playing basketball because they got to do something. I've always said the most important fall sport at Duke is basketball recruiting, and that's pretty much true at Indiana. But you're right, Tom Allen's done a terrific job. And to say that he out-coached James Franklin on Saturday is a vast understatement, because James Franklin lost his mind when they took over up 21-20 on down. And if they kneel three times, then at worst, Indiana's going to get the ball back with about 15 seconds left and no timeout. And, you know, then he kind of threw the kid under the bus saying, well, he wasn't supposed to score. Well, did you make that clear? Why did he score? And why hand off? Why not keep it in the quarterback's hand so there can't be a fumble? It was really bad coaching by James Franklin. And I know the Penn State people are screaming that the two-point conversion, the kid came up, Penix, right? Penix Jr., an inch short. Well, it was too close, as Mike Ferreira said, it was too close to overturn. And you wouldn't have been in that situation at all if your coach hadn't fallen asleep at the wheel. So all credit to Tom Allen, all blame to James Franklin. And I don't blame it on the Penn State kids. I blame it on him.
There was a lot of phenomenal videography and photography of the two-point conversion.
Yes, there was.
None of which was definitive in the least, despite everybody on Twitter saying, see, this proves he was in. See, this proves he wasn't in. It's just one of those plays I think we're never going to know if he was in or out.
Right, and that's why, you know, when Mike Pereira said, and I think he's really good, by the way, you can't overturn this. And yes, I have a bias toward Indiana because of my relationship with the school going way back. And by the way, Bob Knight turned 80 yesterday. But I'm not sitting there screaming, you know, wearing cream and crimson while the game is going on. I'm just watching the game. And I couldn't tell live whether he'd gotten the ball to the marker. And the official said he was there. And I don't think you can overturn that call. If the official had said he was short, then it would have been correct to keep that call, too. But he didn't.
You know you can't tell when the sports books in Las Vegas are paying back those who lost that game.
Really?
But yeah, they paid back the money.
Why?
Because it was inconclusive. You
but
couldn't
the call's
tell.
The call. They won the game.
The call's the call. They paid it back.
If I'm a sports
they paid
book,
it back.
I say sorry. You know, there are bad calls in games all the time. I'm not sure that was a bad call, by the way.
John
Feinstein. I don't really get that. But you're right, though, Jonathan. To your point, it was that close. It was definitely that close. But my larger point in this is it never should have come to that. If James Franklin does the job he's paid $2-4 million to do every year, like I don't know how much. If he does his job, the game never comes down to that.
John, thank you as always for the time. We appreciate the recap of the weekend. One more thing.
Yeah, I got one more thing because I got to ask a college basketball question when I get John on.
I'm with you, Chad.
Sean Miller at Arizona. We knew that it could be bad. It was very bad. Five level one allegations levied against him, including the lack of institutional control at Arizona. What have your dealings with Sean Miller been like, and what do you think of this story now with him at Arizona?
You know, it's funny you ask it that way. I've known Sean Miller since he was a freshman at Pitt. When I was doing my second book, A Season Inside, Pitt was one of the schools I followed closely. Terrific kid, really good player, started for 4 years there. I think he's a hell of a coach. He's proved it through the years, particularly at Xavier. But if these allegations are true, he's got to be fired. I mean, it's that simple. I don't know why the heck it takes 3 years from the FBI report till now for the NCAA to get around to saying, here's what we think you're guilty of. But that's the NCAA. And that said, I like Sean Miller. I think he's a very good basketball coach. And if these allegations are true, the school's got to fire him. They just have to.
John, thank you as always. We will catch up again next Monday.
I will look forward to it. Thanks, guys.